Welcome back to the Deep Dive. So I want to start today with a mental image. I want you to just picture a group of people, let's say roughly 70 years old.
Okay.
And they're sitting around a table, you know, maybe it's a virtual one, maybe a kitchen table, and they are tackling one of the most sophisticated technological challenges we have right now.
Generative AI.
Generative artificial intelligence.
Yes. And, you know, usually when you picture that scene, you're imagining a lot of frustration.
Oh, completely.
You're imagining tech support calls to the grandkids.
You're imagining the, how do I open this PDF conversation?
Exactly. Resistance.
But the story we're unpacking today, it just completely shatters that stereotype. We're looking at a group of 70-year-olds who didn't just learn to use AI. They mastered it. They used it to produce this multimedia masterpiece called Memories and Miracles.
It's a fascinating case study, really, in adaptability. And what makes it so unique is the background of this specific group.
Right.
We need to be really clear about who these people are. As children, they were farm kids.
Okay.
I mean, they grew up milking cows, hauling hay, fixing fences out in the mud, that kind of work.
Right. But, and this is a really crucial distinction, they are not farmers now.
No, absolutely not. That's the key.
I haven't spent the last 40 years on a tractor.
Not at all. They've spent their adult lives building careers in business, in professional settings.
So they're polished, capable people.
Very. They're still active, doing really meaningful things in retirement or still working. So you have this incredible combination, the grit and the, you know, figure it out mentality of a farm upbringing,
yeah,
layered with decades of professional business acumen.
And now, at 70, they're applying all of that to a high-tech project to honor their past.
Precisely.
The project itself is a commemorative book, but really, it's so much more than that. It's collecting stories from missionaries who served in Finland between 1972 and 1975. And it's all a gift for their mission mother, a woman named Sister Faye Wade.
But the mission of this deep dive isn't just to, you know, review a book. It's to understand how a group of non-tech wizards use this ethos of getting things done to preserve history.
And our source for this is a document titled Origin of the Book Docs, and it is just a masterclass in problem solving.
We are going to get into the nuts and bolts of the AI, the privacy laws they had to navigate, all of it. But I have to tease one thing before we really jump in.
Oh, I think I know where you're going with this.
There is a gentleman on this committee. His name is Mike Nyborg.
Mm-hmm.
And amidst all this talk of high technology and deep history, Mike offers maybe the most practical piece of life advice I have ever heard.
It concerns the interaction between humans and very large mammals.
Specifically riding wild moose.
Yes.
Spoiler alert, Mike's advice is don't do it.
A strong don't.
A very strong don't. But we will get to the where and the why of that moose incident a little later.
Yeah.
First, let's unpack the why of this entire project, because this wasn't just a hobby. This started with a realization that history was, well, in danger of being lost.
It really begins with this concept of the story saver.
Yeah.
You know, we often think of history as this, like, static thing that just lives in books on a shelf.
Right. It's just there.
But it's not. History is actually incredibly fragile. It lives in memory. And if that memory isn't captured, it evaporates.
And the spark for this whole project,
yeah,
the source zero, if you want to call it that, comes from a chance encounter that just perfectly illustrates that fragility.
Mm.
And it starts in the most American of settings, a Walmart aisle.
In the year 2020, yeah. The classic Walmart summit.
It's amazing what happens there.
It really is. How many life-changing conversations happen right next to the bulk cereal? So we have Darwin Rasmussen, who is known in the group as Valley Rasmussen.
Yeah.
He runs into a man named Bill. Now, Bill was a former home teacher of Darwin's, but he'd been inactive in the church for a very long time.
And usually those run-ins are polite, but, you know, surface level. Hi, how are you? Good to see you.
Totally. But this one was different. They stood there and talked for an hour. Yeah. And for some reason, after 54 years of silence on this topic, Bill decided to open up. He told Darwin a story from his mission days that he had never shared with anyone.
And this is the story of the Florence flood of 1966. And I want to pause here because I think for a modern audience, we might not grasp the scale of this event.
You know.
I was looking into the context, and this was not just a wet basement situation.
Oh, not even close. This was a cataclysm. The Arno River in Florence is, you know, usually pretty placid. It's beautiful. But in November 1966, after days and days of rain, it burst.
Okay.
And you have to understand the hydrodynamics here. It wasn't just water.
What else was in it?
Well, When the river surged, it ruptured heating oil tanks in the basements of buildings all through the city.
So you have water mixing with heating oil.
And raw sewage.
Oh, God.
And tons of silt and mud. This viscous, toxic slurry just slammed into the city at 40 miles per hour.
It's 40 miles per hour.
It reached heights of 13, sometimes 20 feet in some places. It didn't just flood Florence, it buried it.
And Bill was there. He was missionary in Florence when this happened.
He and his companion were in their apartment on the second story. They looked out the window and just saw the city being destroyed. And this is where that get it done mentality first shows up, you know, decades before this book committee.
Right.
They realized they couldn't proselytize. You can't knock on doors when the doors are underwater.
So they decided to serve.
They put on their boots and they waded out into that toxic mix. The locals later gave them a name. They called them the Angels of the Mud.
Angels of the Mud. Wow.
And they made their way to the Piazza del Duomo, specifically to the Battistero, the San Giovanni, the Baptistery.
It's one of the oldest buildings in Florence. It's a UNESCO World Heritage Site.
It is the heart of the Renaissance. And on the east side of the Baptistery, there were these massive, famous bronze doors. They were known as the Gates of Paradise.
Created by Lorenzo Ghiberti.
That's the one. And just to give you some art history context here, it was Michelangelo who nicknamed them the Gates of Paradise.
Oh.
Ghiberti spent 21 years on the first set of doors and 27 years on these. They're considered the defining masterpiece that moved art from the Gothic era into the Renaissance.
So they're priceless.
Utterly priceless.
And Bill finds them. Where?
In the mud. The force of the water had ripped 10 of the panels off these massive doors. Bill and his companion found them in the basement, just submerged in a foot of sludge.
Oh my gosh.
And you have to remember, these are heavy bronze panels. The water is still a threat. If they get washed away, they are gone, maybe forever.
But so what do? Do they, like, call a curator?
There were no phones working. There were no curators to call. It was just two 19-year-old boys in a flooded basement. So they literally kicked and shoved these priceless panels to safety.
Wait, they kicked them?
They kicked them. They moved them to higher ground, physically saving them from being swept down the river and out to sea.
That's like Indiana Jones stuff.
It is.
But without the whip and the hat.
Yeah.
Just, you know, muddy missionaries.
And here is the kicker. Bill didn't tell anyone for 54 years.
Why? I don't understand that. If I saved a Renaissance masterpiece, I would lead with that story at every dinner party for the rest of my life.
I think it's a complex psychology. You know, sometimes when you witness that level of destruction, people lost their lives, thousands lost their homes, your own individual acts of heroism can feel small in comparison.
That makes sense.
Or maybe he just viewed it as doing the work, you know? He didn't see it as this grand historical act. He saw it as moving heavy metal out of the mud because it needed to be moved.
But telling Darwin in that Walmart aisle, that unlocked something for him.
It broke the dam. Darwin told him, Bill, this story needs to be told.
Mm.
And Darwin connected him with the right people. Eventually, a letter of appreciation was arranged from the mayor of Florence.
Wow.
And for Bill, just seeing that his story had value, it changed his trajectory. He had been inactive for so long, but he became active again. He saw that his service mattered.
And the notes mention this beautiful little coda to Bill's story.
Yes. He eventually found love and got married on a hilltop in Italy, overlooking the Adriatic.
A full circle moment.
It really was.
But this one story, the Angels of the Mud, it becomes the catalyst for the whole Memories and Miracles book.
Mm.
Because Darwin realized something, I think, terrifying.
He realized that if Bill had died without that chance conversation in Walmart, that story was gone forever.
Wow.
The fact that two Mormon missionaries saved the Gates of Paradise would have been lost to history. And Darwin thought, if Bill has a story like that, what about the rest of us? What about the 100 missionaries who served in Finland?
It just triggered this domino effect.
Mm-hmm.
Darwin tells his friend John, who then connects him to the church history department. Suddenly, Darwin is meeting with the director for the North European region.
And this theme emerges that you mentioned earlier, story savers. You start to see this happening everywhere. Darwin's own bishop back in Idaho was collecting stories.
Right.
Sister Wade's son, Brian, was apparently always asking for stories at their mission reunions.
So there was this collective consciousness just waking up.
Exactly. Realizing that the generation from the 70s is getting older and their stories are still just in their heads.
So the seed is planted.
Hmm.
But every project, you know, needs that moment where it goes from just a nice idea to, okay, we're actually doing this.
Right, the point of no return. The source material uses this great aviation analogy for it. It says, it's like being a student pilot. You're flying the plane, everything is chaotic, you're just watching the dials, and then suddenly, click, you just understand how to land.
The pivot point.
That moment happened for Darwin in a conversation with Sister Faye Wade. They were swapping stories back and forth, you know, just enjoying the memories. And Darwin asks a very simple question. He says, would you like to have your missionaries write their stories for you?
And what did she say?
She responds, like in a book. And he says, yes. And in that one moment, the obligation was created. Memories and Miracles was born.
But, I mean, saying we're going to make a book is the easy part.
Oh, yeah.
Actually corralling 100 people, editing their writing, fixing photos, publishing it, that is a massive logistical undertaking.
Especially when your goal is to make it a multimedia extravaganza, which is what they wanted.
So let's meet the team that pulled this off, the committee. And this is where we have to go back to that farm kid profile.
Right. We established their business professionals now, but the source material emphasizes their childhoods for a very specific reason. When you grow up on a farm, you learn a specific type of problem solving. It's linear and it's non-negotiable.
If the cows need milking, you milk them. It doesn't matter if it's raining or if you're tired or if you don't feel like it.
Exactly. And if a tractor breaks, you don't form a committee to discuss the theory of tractor repair. You just get a wrench.
You get it done.
You get it done. And that's the ethos they brought to this book. They viewed the technical challenges not as impossible barriers, but just as broken fences that needed fixing.
So let's look at the roster. First, we have Burke Reese or Veal Reese.
Burke is the master editor. Now, he had a bit of a leg up. He had just finished writing his own book, The Majesty of Jesus Christ, in the summer of 2025.
So he was fresh off a project.
Exactly. He understood structure, narrative flow, headings. He was the one who was going to ensure this didn't read like a random scrapbook, but like a cohesive narrative.
Then we have Gary Carter, Veli Carter.
Gary is the musician. He's a former member of the Tabernacle Choir.
Okay, so that tells you something about his level of discipline and his ear for quality.
Absolutely. He knew that Sister Wade loved music, so he was the one who insisted, we cannot just have text. We need music to set the spiritual tone.
Hmm.
He's described as a man who knows how to move a project forward.
Next up is Darwin Rasmussen, who we've already mentioned. He's the architect.
Darwin is the glue. He's the one who saw all the seeds being planted. He's also an author. He wrote a book called I Am a Missionary, which was a narrative rewrite of his own journals. He describes his role on this project as the typist and the quick learner. He's the one who was willing to just sit down and grind through that technical learning curve.
And then we have Joanne Hunter.
Yes. And the source material is very specific about her role.
How so?
She was the feminine touch of the book committee.
Okay.
Which, and I'm basically quoting here, meant that the men knew they should do things right.
Right. So she kept everyone in line, made sure the quality was there.
That's the impression you get, yes. A crucial presence.
And finally, we have the wild card, Mike Nyborg.
Mike is described as the deep thinker, a man who thinks about things and makes them right.
So in a business context, he's the strategist.
Exactly. He's the one who looks at the plan and spots the flaws before they happen.
But Mike also contributes to the lore of this group with a very specific anecdote involving wildlife.
We have to be very clear about the geography on this one because it matters.
Okay.
Mike rode a wild moose, but he did not do this in Finland.
Where did he do it?
He did this in Idaho.
Which, honestly, I don't know if that makes it better or worse. Moose in Idaho are massive.
They are massive everywhere. And Mike's professional assessment, looking back on this event, is simply, it is not a good idea to ride a moose.
I love that. Mm-hmm. It's just so understated. It must have been a terrifying few seconds.
Oh, I'm sure.
But it humanizes them, doesn't it? These aren't stuffy academics sitting around. These are people who've lived full, adventurous lives.
It shows a certain willingness to just engage with the world. You know, sometimes that means riding a moose, and sometimes that means mastering AI. It's the same spirit of, let's see what happens if I try this.
So let's pivot to the mastering AI part, because this really is the core contradiction of the whole story.
Mm.
You have a group of 70-year-olds accustomed to business and hard work facing a technology that baffles 20-year-olds.
And they didn't just use it for a spell check.
Oh.
They used it to solve fundamental structural problems with the entire book project.
Okay, so let's start with the writing. They had submissions from 100 different missionaries. I have to imagine the writing styles varied wildly.
That is putting it mildly. You have some people who are natural storytellers, and then you have others who probably haven't written a paragraph since college. The committee described themselves as the copy and paste team. They didn't want to manually rewrite everyone's stories.
So they used AI as a force multiplier.
Exactly. They fed the raw text into the AI, and they just asked it to fix grammar, to improve sentence structure, enhance the flow, but without changing the core meaning or the voice.
It allowed them to act as editors-in-chief without having to line edit, you know, hundreds of pages by hand.
Huge time saver. But the real genius and the real legal maneuvering came with the visual.
Because they hit a brick wall with photographs, didn't they?
A huge wall. And this is where their business background really kicked in. They were informed by another missionary, Vili Modi Shah, about the strict privacy laws in Europe, specifically GDPR.
The right to be forgotten.
You got it. In Europe, you cannot publish a photo of a person without their explicit consent.
Right.
Now, imagine a photo taken in a Helsinki market square in 1973. There are 50 people in the background.
You can't track them down. It's impossible.
Totally impossible. You'd need release forms from 50 people, most of whom might be deceased or completely untraceable. A strictly by-the-book legal team would have said, okay, no photos, text only.
Which would have made for a very boring commemorative book.
Very boring. But this committee said, okay, we need visuals, we can't use the photos, so what can we do? And they turned to generative AI images.
This is such a smart workaround.
It's brilliant. They took the descriptions of the scenes from the stories, or maybe even just the composition of the original photos, and they asked the AI to generate artwork.
What kind of art?
Things like pencil drawings, charcoal sketches, watercolor paintings.
So they created a vibe.
They captured the essence without the biometrics.
That's a great way to put it.
If the story was about tracking in the snow in a city called Tampere, they had the AI generate a charcoal sketch of two missionaries walking down a snowy street in Tampere, you know, wearing 1970s clothing.
It sets the mood perfectly. Oh. It illustrates the story, but because the faces are just generated, it violates no privacy laws.
And you could argue it created a better product in the end.
How so?
Well, instead of a bunch of grainy black and white snapshots that are maybe out of focus, you have this cohesive artistic aesthetic that runs through the entire book.
It elevated it from a scrapbook to an art book.
That's it. That is the business pro mindset at work. Identify the constraint, which was GDPR, find the tool, which was AI, and deliver the result, which was art.
Now, we mentioned music earlier. Gary Carter wanted music. But you can't exactly print a song in a book.
Right. And they didn't have a budget to go out and hire an orchestra.
So what did they do?
This is where the intergenerational learning comes in. Enter Jeff, Darwin's son. Now, Jeff is the tech guru of the family. He's a webcaster. He produces hundreds of family history webinars every year. He lives in this world.
So he became the mentor for his dad.
He taught his dad, Darwin, how to use AI music tools like Suno. He showed him that you can take the text of an article, you know, the emotional core of a story, feed it into the AI, and then specify a genre.
Like, make me a folk song about walking in the rain in Finland.
Exactly like that. And the AI composes the melody, it creates the harmony, and it even generates the vocals. They ended up with 47 original songs included with the project.
That is mind-blowing. 47 songs.
And Darwin noted something really profound about this process. He said, sometimes a song tells a story better than text. Music can bypass the intellect and go straight to the emotion. By adding that layer, they created that multimedia extravaganza that immerses you in the feeling of the mission.
And the validation for this whole approach, it came from the top, didn't it?
It did. Darwin went to Roots Tech in 2025. It's this massive genealogy conference in Salt Lake City.
Right.
And the main theme of the entire conference was stories and AI.
I could just imagine him sitting in the audience.
The experts are on stage and they're telling everyone, this is the future. You need to use AI to make history accessible. You need to create these media experiences to engage the younger generation. And Darwin is just sitting there smiling, thinking to himself, my committee of 70-year-olds just did exactly that.
But they didn't wait for the seminar? They didn't wait for permission?
They just did.
It just validates all their instincts. They proved that you don't need to be a digital native to be a digital innovator.
You just need to be curious and willing to do the work.
I want to shift gears a little bit to the content of the book itself, because all this tech, the AI art, the generated music, it's all in service of something very, very human.
The stories.
The stories. And there was this fascinating psychological phenomenon that happened where they started collecting these stories from everyone. We can call it the confession. The confession. What was it?
Almost every single missionary admitted the same thing, which was, I thought I was the only one.
The only one who, what? The only one who struggled. Or saw miracles.
Both. They thought their spiritual experiences were unique to them. They thought I was the only one seeing these kinds of miracles, or I was the only one having these profound moments. You know, mission life can be very isolating. You spend a lot of time in your own head.
So for 50 years, they've been carrying these stories around in isolation.
Right. But as the stories started pouring in for the book and the committee started sharing them with the group, the walls just came down. They realized that everyone had these incredible experiences. It was this collective outpouring of spirit that they hadn't even recognized at the time.
That must have been incredibly emotional for them to realize.
Oh, hugely. There's a mention of a Sister Allman in the source. She's currently serving a senior mission in South Africa. She wrote to the committee after reading the draft of the book. She said she was crying by page 3. She told them, "You didn't warn me I was going to need boxes of Kleenex."
And it's not just about the spiritual highs, is it? It's also about the physical lows.
Mm-hmm.
The reality of being in Finland in the 1970s.
And this is where the committee draws a very hard line. They make this distinction between the walk and the tech.
Let's unpack that. What does that mean?
So the tech is what the committee did. The AI, the editing, the layout. They view that as just copy and paste work, you know, humble work.
Okay.
But the walk is what the 19-year-old missionaries actually did. And the book is brutally honest about what that walk was like.
We're talking about the physical conditions.
Finland is a beautiful country, but it is harsh.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in winter, we're talking about the darkness where the sun barely rises, the bitter, bitter cold, the snow and the ice.
And the diet. I saw that in the notes.
The diet. The stories mention weeks on end of eating just rice, peas, and yogurt.
Peas and yogurt.
That was what they could afford and what was available.
I can't imagine eating peas and yogurt for 3 weeks straight while walking 10 miles a day in the snow.
And doing it in worn-out shoes. That's one of the recurring details in the stories. The gear, they wore out their shoes, they wore out their bicycle tires, they wore out their suit pants. They literally walked the fabric off their own bodies.
That's the walk.
That is the walk. And the committee's goal was to use the tech to honor the walk. They didn't want the technology to overshadow the sacrifice. They wanted it to illuminate it.
Right.
They wanted the grandchildren to see that charcoal sketch of the worn-out shoes and really understand the price that was paid.
It's a beautiful synthesis, really.
Mm-hmm.
Using the cutting edge of 2026 to honor the grit of 1972.
It is, and it's landing in a big way. This isn't just a PDF that they're emailing around to each other. There are formal events scheduled for this.
We're recording this in February of 2026, so these dates are coming up really fast.
Very fast. April 3rd, 2026. It's a doubleheader. At 11:00, there is a formal presentation to the Church History Department in Salt Lake City.
So that's the official institutional recognition.
Right. You know, parking passes, suits, the whole bit. They are formally accepting this into the historical canon.
But the more emotional event is that evening.
That evening, at 7 p.m., the reunion.
And this is where Sister Wade comes in.
Yes. This is the official gifting of the book to Sister Faye Wade, the woman who asked, like in a book. She's finally going to receive the finished product with all the art, the songs, the stories.
And the Wade family is a big part of this too, right?
They are. The committee made sure to include the Wade children and Sister Wade herself in the history. It's not just about the missionaries. It's about the entire mission leadership family.
It closes the loop.
It really does. It closes the loop on that relationship.
And beyond just the reunion, the book is getting a permanent home.
Two homes, actually. It's being archived in the BYU Harold B. Lee Library, which is a massive repository of history, and also in the Northern European Church History Department in London.
So Bill's story of the flood. Preserved.
Preserved.
The peas and yogurt.
Preserved.
Preserved.
Mike's advice about the moose. Definitely preserved for posterity.
All of it. Saved from the mud of forgetfulness.
That's a great way to put it.
So let's bring this all together. We've talked about the flood, the farm kids, the AI, the legacy. What's the big takeaway here? When we look at Burke, Gary, Darwin, Joanne, and Mike, what are they really teaching us?
I think the core lesson is about agency. It's the refusal to be a victim of your own lack of skills.
That is a powerful way to put that.
It is so easy to say, I'm 70, the world has moved on, I don't understand these computers.
And it's a valid excuse. Nobody would blame them for that.
Not at all. But this group looked at the project and said, the goal is more important than my discomfort.
They treated the skill gap just like a broken fence on the farm.
Exactly. I don't know how to do this. It wasn't a stop sign for them. It was just another problem to solve.
Wow.
I don't have the talent, so I will find the tool. I don't know the software, so I will find a teacher.
It just redefines what it means to be capable, doesn't it? You don't have to know everything, you just have to know how to learn.
And you have to care enough about the outcome. That's the key. They cared about Sister Wade, they cared about their own history, and that love is what drove the learning.
I keep going back to the Angels of the Mud.
It's the perfect metaphor for the whole thing.
It really is.
You have Bill wading into the sludge to save those doors, and then you have the committee wading into the sludge of AI and all these technical hurdles to save the memories. It's the same act.
One is physical, one is digital, but the spirit is completely identical.
Mm-hmm.
It's about seeing value where other people might just see a mess and then doing the work to save it.
And it leaves a challenge for the listener, I think.
What's that?
What stories are you leaving in the mud?
Mm.
We all have them. Stories from our parents, our grandparents, our own lives. And we tell ourselves, I'll write that down someday, or I'm not a writer, or I don't know how to make a book.
And Bill waited 54 years.
Mm-hmm. And he almost missed his window. If he hadn't bumped into Darwin in that Walmart, that story dies with him. The committee is basically shouting at us, don't wait, the tools are here, the AI can help you. That farm kid spirit is in you, even if you've never milked a cow in your life. Just get it done.
Save the story.
Save the story.
And as a secondary, but I think equally important lesson.
Yes.
Listen to Mike Nyborg.
Always listen to Mike.
If you see a moose, whether it's in Idaho or Finland or anywhere else, admire it from a distance.
Take a picture. Have the AI make a charcoal sketch of it.
But do not climb on its back.
Do not.
Wise words to live by. This has been such an inspiring deep dive. To the Committee of Memories and Miracles, congratulations.
Yeah.
You've really set a bar for all of us.
Absolutely. A job well done.
And to our listeners, thank you for joining us. We hope this pushes you to start your own project. Go find your stories, pick up a new tool, and we will see you on the next deep dive.
Goodbye, everyone.
See ya.